Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
What do you suppose happens to Occupy Wall Street when they're not actually occupying anything anymore? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 15th of November. Good to have you with us. And the city they say never sleeps actually didn't sleep last night, at least not the small part of it, in and around Zuccotti Park and Occupy Wall Street in Lower Manhattan. Police moved in about 1 o'clock this morning, arrested more than 200 people, and cleared the place out.
Who do you protect? Who do you protect? Who do you protect?
This whole thing that happened, all it does is rejuvenate everybody, put us back into the media spotlight, show exactly how our First Amendment rights have been taken away. So, I mean, I have to thank Mayor Bloomberg for helping us out in this sense.
I think the work continues. It's just a matter of whether we're going to have an occupied space from now on or not. And where would that be?
Folks, you can circle the block, but you got to clear this corner, all right, please? All right? We're not saying you got to leave, but you got to clear this corner.
The events of the wee small hours put the birthplace of the Occupy movement in pretty much the same boat as protesters in Portland and Salt Lake City and Oakland, California. That is, without a place to occupy. We spoke to historian Jeremy Suri a couple of months ago when the movement started. We've called him back to talk about the events of the day. Jeremy, good to have you with us.
Nice to be on the show.
How important do you think the physical presence turns out to be?
I think the physical presence is very important because, number one, it attracts people's attention, and number two, it provides a space where people can organize, exchange information, and plan out their strategy.
What's that strategy going to be, though, now that they are of necessity someplace else?
Well, I think the strategy is going to be to try to find another place or to get back to the park and other places where they were before. We've already seen many of these Occupy movements move onto college campuses. I think we'll see them do that. But we'll also see the desire to get back to the original space as a cause that will motivate people and will bring more attention and more people out in the streets.
Is it possible that Mike Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, did these guys a favor by shutting them down when winter's coming and in theory the outside presence was going to get smaller anyway?
I think he did. And to tell you the truth, I don't understand why he made this move right now. I think, as you said, the weather was working in his favor. And what he's done now is he's given them a cause celeb. He's motivated people to come out. He's evoked sympathy for the protesters. And they will get more people to come into the streets now because of what Bloomberg did than they would have before.
Sort of the follow-on question then is, why did he let them stay so long? Why did anybody in Oakland or Portland or where have you let them stay so long?
Well, I think people underestimated their permanence and how long they would be able to organize and mobilize themselves. And also, no one wanted to be responsible for sending in the police to remove them. That's not a pleasant situation. So they hoped it would go away. And of course, it didn't.
Yeah. Short of one of the members of the Occupy movement getting elected to Congress in November, how are we going to know that they have succeeded? I mean, let's posit that they succeeded in getting income inequality into the national discussion. But then what?
Well, I think we will know they've succeeded if we see a block of voters come out in the primaries and particularly in the presidential election and in local elections that occur at the same time and have influence on the outcome. If we go back, Kai, and we look at the results and say in these close elections that we're likely to have, a group of voters who didn't vote before or didn't vote in these blocks before came out and voted for a candidate because they felt the candidate was addressing their issues, we'll say they mattered.
Use your history professor lens then and tell me what those candidates are going to stand for. Is it going to be the Democratic side of the ledger, I imagine?
I think it's going to have to be. And I think it's going to be Democrats who come out, perhaps even President Obama, and talk about real measures they're going to take to address economic inequality and to address the limitations on economic mobility in our society today.
All points granted, but we're not seeing Barack Obama down at Zuccotti Park. We're not seeing Nancy Pelosi. We're not seeing Democratic politicians embrace them the way some Republican politicians embrace the Tea Party with their smaller government, lower taxes move.
I think that's true, but I think we will see Democratic politicians, particularly local and state politicians, and maybe even the president as we go on, embrace this.
You know, with all the reports that there have been the past few weeks of violence and problems in these Occupy camps, this is a bit of a stretch. Could you call this Occupy's Altamont moment?
I don't think it's the Altamont moment, but I think it's 1967. which is when there's, you know, a sort of buildup of a movement, and it could go in many different directions. And we will see it go in multiple directions. There'll be different offshoots, and it'll look different in different cities. But anytime you add police force to a situation like this, it makes things potentially much more violent.
Jeremy Suri is a professor of history at the University of Texas. Jeremy, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
A state judge ruled on the case this afternoon, by the way, said protesters can go back into the park. No tents, no sleeping bags, though. Around the corner and a couple of blocks down Wall Street from Zuccotti Park, traders went about their merry way today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The question we're offering this week relates directly to the news of the day this Monday, the Occupy protests and what happens next. Would the 99%, we'd like to know, be better off if the 1% had less? Our commentator yesterday said, yes, they would. Today, Rehan Salam.
Recently, the top 1% has drawn a tremendous amount of attention. In part, that is because America's highest earners have enjoyed a robust recovery, while most of the rest of the country has not. Wall Street, in particular, has fared very well. Fueled by bailout money, the so-called too-big-to-fail banks have been making big, risky bets on short-term price movements that, so far at least, have paid off. Given that excessive risk-taking on Wall Street is what got us into our economic mess, it is no surprise that this kind of behavior has led to resentment. But even if we fixed our financial system, even if we made it much less risky, there is good reason to believe that the top 1% would continue to pull ahead. Between 2007 and 2009, the share of earnings that went to the top 1% fell from 23.5% to 17.6%, a steep drop of 6 percentage points. While the super rich are hardly the most sympathetic victims of financial instability, they happen to have a lot to lose from wild boom and bust cycles. All Americans would benefit from a more stable financial system, but the top 1% might benefit most of all. Why is that? Well, a better functioning, more stable financial system will mean a bigger economic pie and more good-paying jobs for everyone. But it will also mean more successful entrepreneurs, more successful business executives, and more superstars in various other fields. Wall Streeters might wind up earning much less, but the most successful earners in Silicon Valley and Hollywood and the manufacturing belt might wind up with much more. Now, if all we cared about is inequality, this would be a disappointment. But if we cared about a more flourishing, more innovative economy, fixing the financial system would still be a no-brainer, even if it meant more inequality. So instead of talking about the 1% or the 99%, let's focus on how a broken financial system hurts the bottom line of America as a whole.
Rehan Salam is a policy advisor at E21. That's an economics think tank. Tomorrow, Robert Reich on the same question. Is everyone else better off if the 1% has less? What's your take? Let us know at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. We've got a whiz-bang new website here at Marketplace. Check it out when you get a chance. And we're on Twitter and Facebook and all the rest. It kind of, you have to be these days. But the really big consumer products companies have digital strategy types, constantly studying buying patterns and pumping out streams of online deals. Go down to the other end of the spectrum, though, and a lot of businesses are still operating in a nearly technology-free zone. The quirky retailer, the fledgling bakery, are often on the wrong side of the digital divide, as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Miki Nishihata started Hello Bicycle 3 years ago, almost by accident.
It started out as a hobby with barely anything going, and then it grew to be fairly well-known in Seattle, and we have a lot of customers now, and things are going well for us.
When Nishihata needs to straighten a spoke or mend a chain or change a flat, he knows exactly the right tool to reach for. But until recently, when it came to using technology to build his business, he felt like he was banging rocks together, hoping for a spark.
Small businesses are hurting for technology because most of us live in the Stone Age.
There are tons of stats about the digital divide for small businesses in this country, and they're not good.
I've always heard about 50% of small business owners don't even have a website.
Reva Lasansky is a small business consultant.
When someone is looking for something, whether it's local or national, they're going online to find it. And if you don't have a website, you're not going to be found.
For many businesses, even basic technology can still be a struggle. millions of small business people still aren't set up to accept credit cards. And Nishihata says figuring out how to take plastic was a hassle.
Credit card processing requires a dedicated phone line.
You need a special account with a bank.
Then you need the machine.
There were setup costs.
The learning curve is kind of high.
And there's a waiting period. So for its first year, Hello Bicycle took only cash. Sales suffered. But Lisansky says there are lots of cheap, even free technologies out there that can make things easier if store owners experiment a bit. Hello Bicycle eventually started using a credit card system called Square.
Because it's just so simple. It's exceedingly simple for what it does. You basically get a device. It's about the size of a quarter, except for it's square, like the name. And you plug it in the phone jack of an Android or iPhone. And using their app, you just swipe a card through it.
Customers sign the phone with their finger. Jack Dorsey, who helped create Twitter, co-founded Square a few years ago because he thought getting set up to take plastic was just too complicated.
So the idea behind Square is what can we do to get the entire process down to a download?
Now credit cards account for 90% of Hello Bicycle's sales, and Nishihata's business has tripled. Other sites out there make it incredibly easy for local shops to post their inventory and prices online. Jack Abraham created Milo.
Milo will actually search the inventory systems of stores near you in real time and tell you which stores have that product that you're looking for, so you can go in and buy it today.
Milo lets local shops compete with the online giants by getting their goods on mobile phones and computer screens and in front of thousands of potential customers. Lisansky says small business people have to embrace technology like this if they want to survive, even if they're intimidated.
If you feel like, oh, that technology, you know, round up a neighborhood kid. They can do it for you. It's that simple.
Today in Silicon Valley, it's never been easier or cheaper to launch a startup. New websites don't need big servers anymore. They rent rack space in the cloud. Entrepreneurs use technology to outsource everything they can. They're ruthlessly efficient. And Lisansky says mom-and-pop shops should take note. And remember, successful entrepreneurs were small business people, too. Even guys like Jack Abraham.
Yep, we slept on arrow beds and lived out of our office.
Then last year, Jack Abraham sold Milo to eBay for tens of millions of dollars. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Coming up.
In very few places do people starve to death simply because there's a drought.
Why politics makes famines deadly. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials edged up a 10th percent today, 17 points, closed at 12,096. The NASDAQ up 1%, 28 points, 2686 at the bell. The S&P 500 gained almost a half percent. That's 6 points, in case you're wondering, ended at 12.57. Financial stocks were mixed. Bank of America deposited 1.3%. J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs each added just shy of about a half percent. Warren Buffett takes a stake in Intel, and stock is the better for it by nearly 3% today. Hewlett Packard clicked up 3.3%. Apple baked on 2.5% today. Microsoft up 0.2%. Bond prices held steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note stands at 2.04%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at Marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at Marketplace.org/the Big Book.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for October. On Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee holds a hearing titled Manufacturing in the USA, Paving the Road to Job Creation. And it's the United Nations International Day for Tolerance. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. So let's take two big stories in the news this week, the European debt crisis and the NBA lockout, and do a little compare and contrast. On the face of it, not a whole lot in common. Banks versus bank shots, if you will. But Marketplace's David Gura explains the European Union and the NBA are kind of playing the same game.
We all know that some European countries are struggling, like Italy and Greece, and that there are other countries in much better shape, like Germany.
It is kind of like the NBA, where you have small market teams and large market teams.
David Berry is an economist at Southern Utah University, a sports economist. In the NBA, a handful of teams, the Celtics, the Lakers, they do better than teams in smaller markets. They make a lot more money. And Berry says that's raised a provocative question.
Why don't the rich teams start kicking in some money into the pot?
In a way, small market NBA teams and struggling European economies are making the same argument. Brad Humphreys is also a sports economist. He teaches at the University of Alberta.
It's important for the overall well-being of everybody in the union or in the league that sometimes some of the worse-off members need help from the better-off members.
Humphreys says Europe and the NBA are learning a valuable lesson about growth. They may have overexpanded when times were good, and now they're paying the price. But there's at least one key difference between the EU and the NBA. Germany and the European Union may be able to do without a country like Greece, but the Lakers, like every other high-revenue-earning team, need other teams to play. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
Score one for the folks who sell frozen pizzas and French fries to schools. They have convinced Congress to put the kibosh on stricter school lunch standards. The Department of Agriculture had proposed some new rules aimed at fighting childhood obesity, but House and Senate negotiators stripped them out of a spending bill they're working on. Seems they didn't want to give pizza and potatoes a bad name. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has that story.
The USDA's idea for improving school lunches basically came down to this: fewer potatoes, less salt, more whole grains, and no, 2 tablespoons of tomato paste doesn't count as a vegetable. But those are fighting words to the companies that collectively earn billions every year selling to school cafeterias. Corey Henry at the American Frozen Food Institute says that tomato paste on your kid's slice of lunchroom pizza?
Tomato paste is a very nutrient dense food product. It is rich in vitamin A, vitamin C.
Remind you of when the Reagan administration argued ketchup was a vegetable? Healthy food advocate Margot Wutan says frozen pizza and French fry companies, as well as the salt and potato industries, have aggressively lobbied Congress against the USDA's proposal.
And they have put the interests of business before the interests of our children's health.
According to the New York Times, the industry spent over $5.5 million to fight the changes. But Big Food has a big stake in keeping the status quo. Minnesota-based Schwann, the largest provider of frozen pizza to U.S. schools, earns $750 million a year selling food to schools and other institutions. But advocates like Bhutan say to those companies, this fight wasn't just about the food sold in schools.
They are cultivating a pattern of eating that they hope children will continue throughout the rest of their lifetime.
And continue feeding corporate revenue streams as well. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The famine in East Africa, if this is even possible to believe, has taken a turn for the worst. The United Nations says tens of thousands of people have already died from starvation, and now rains are falling, and cholera has turned up in refugee camps. It's hitting people living on the equivalent of one plate of rice a day. The United Nations says there are going to be 9 billion people on the planet by the year 2045. And so our series, Food for 9 Billion, answers the very basic question of how we're going to feed them all. So here's one clue. Famine is a lot more than simply a drought. Scott Tong reports from the Horn of Africa.
This is a tale of two droughts. Actually, it's just one weather pattern in one dirt-poor part of the world. But there's a border. On the Ethiopia side, the farmers and the herders manage to endure. Whereas in Somalia, by now you've heard about the famine.
It was as if the skin of their bodies was sticking to their bones. Inhumanly grotesque.
No toilets, no clean water. The kids were half naked.
You can go to virtually any family living under a piece of plastic, and they will tell you they've lost 1, 2, 3, or 4 children.
How did famine happen? I stopped first at the biggest refugee camp on Earth. 460,000 Somalis, that's the size of Kansas City, live in Kenya, off UN rations of corn, wheat, cooking oil. 35-year-old Mahmoud Abdurrahman just came.
We had no rains, no water to farm, so we ran away.
He walked 30 days to get out of Somalia.
We had to leave some people behind who got too weak. They were still alive then, but people who came afterward told us they saw dead bodies being eaten by hyenas. One of the bodies was my neighbor. It's terrible.
Abner Rahman feels lucky because he has a donkey. It pulled the cart carrying his four children.
But when we came, we lost one child to starvation, our second daughter. She was 1.5.
Here, everyone talks of the worst drought in two generations. But here's the thing. Other places have drought too. Algeria, Peru, Texas. But no starvation. Andrew Natsios at Georgetown used to run the Agency for International Development.
In very few places do people starve to death simply because there's a drought. The only time people really actually die is when there's some political complication.
Complication is a charitable word for Somalia. It's had no central government for 20 years. There's been internal conflict. There's been outside meddling from the Soviets, from the Americans, from the Ethiopians, and now the Kenyans. And out of the mess arose the Muslim extremist group. Al-Shabaab is known for radical theology and guns and blocking food aid.
The Al-Shabaab movement does not want any food aid distributed in their area because they see it as undermining their authority and their legitimacy.
Western aid competes for influence. Natsios says after an earthquake in Pakistan, U.S. help rushed in. American popularity rose. Al-Qaeda's fell.
Bin Laden was really, really upset, apparently, from what the agency tells me, CIA.
It seems every Somali here has an Al-Shabaab story. I come upon a dusty food stall where there's a radio that must be older than I am.
105.9, Star FM, Nairobi.
Refugee Abdu Shan Ali owns the stall.
The gunmen just came and stole my animals. They chose the fattest goats, cows, and camels.
He fled Somalia 2 years ago in search of help for his wife and his 10 kids. They all stayed behind.
I don't know if they're dead or alive. I ask everyone who comes if they know anything about my family.
He asks to change the subject, puts a couple tomatoes on the scale. And now the difference between drought and famine starts to come into focus. Imagine it's you. By fate, you're born into the world's poorest place. Drought comes, crops fail, food prices triple, you eat everything you have, including your seeds. Your cows and goats provide milk, but the drought kills half of them, and then the gunmen come and take the rest. So you're left with two choices, flee for a refugee camp or wait to die. Now the other side of the river. Same desert climate, same 105-degree heat, same drought. Different planet. This is the sound of government safety net. Ethiopian men chant, "We work to survive," as they dig irrigation trenches. In return, they get food and access to water. 58-year-old Hisak Ali Hassan.
Now we can eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Before, we only ate 2 times a day. We don't eat meat, but we get vegetables, and we can go into town to buy rice.
Now, this is Ethiopia. Remember that famine back in the 80s? Those Live Aid benefit concerts? Back then, Ethiopia faced what Somalia faces now, drought and civil war. Famine then came in part because Ethiopian leaders picked military supplies over food aid, guns over butter.
This is a country which has been the poster child of poverty and hunger.
Ethiopian Foreign Ministry spokesman Getachew Reda was in grade school during that famine. He recalls a beggar came up and snatched a loaf of bread out of his hands, at which point his grandmother screamed, "Shame on you," at the beggar. The beggar shouted back, "Shame on you for giving a child enough food for 10.
I have still vivid pictures of people really starving today, is begging for, you know. That kind of thing is a thing of past, and I think we have come to bury that past.
Ethiopia, like many African countries, has gradually built a series of shock absorbers for droughts. It stores water and grain around the country for emergencies. It gives farmers better seeds and insurance for when crops fail. It's built roads to help get people to the market. The point is to weave a safety net and to lift incomes so enough people won't ever need the net. Economist John Hadanat is with the International Food Policy Research Institute.
That what we do know in countries which have successfully escaped hunger and famine is they've done a whole lot of things right. And when you push on all those fronts, that's when you see famine and hunger disappearing.
Meantime, in Somalia, the seasonal rains have come, raising hopes for the January harvest for the farmers who are still there. And yet in the refugee camps, the next deadly stage of disaster has already shown up. Waterborne diseases like cholera and malaria. In East Africa, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, getting back to the Occupy movement that we started with and this idea that the rich keep on getting richer. If you happen to see 60 Minutes this past Sunday and their story about how lawmakers can trade on pretty much any information they get, insider or not, public or not, you'll be interested to know the Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act of 2011 was introduced in the Senate today. Work out those initials. It's the Stock Act. Clever, huh? All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow edged up 17 points, about a tenth of 1%. The NASDAQ up 28 points, 1% on the nose. The S&P 500 gained 6 points, almost a half percent. Thanks today to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on the broadcast.
If Italy crashes out of the euro, or if Italy reaches the stage where it has to default or leave the euro, that would mean the end of the euro.
And then, yeah, I don't know. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.